COVID-19 hits a nursing home in Broward County. The latest, 3 deaths, all possibly linked to the virus. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The governor recently told people stay away from nursing homes and assisted living facilities. Today, officials are investigating 3 deaths at the Atria Willow Wood facility. We'll get the latest. Also, COVID-19 fears didn't keep everyone home yesterday. Floridians still went to the polls for the primary, and they overwhelmingly supported the former vice president. Could Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' comments about socialist regimes in Latin America have impacted Latino voters here in South Florida? And we'll take a look at Latin America and how different countries are battling the pandemic, some already considering closing their borders. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. One of the more stinging realities of this COVID-19 pandemic is that the virus impacts the elderly in greater numbers than any other age group. We saw that devastation near Seattle, where 26 residents died in a nursing home, 13 confirmed to have had the virus. Yesterday, there were conflicting reports about COVID-19 deaths at assisted living facilities in Broward County. Now, the last report is those 3 were from Atria Willow Wood on West Commercial Boulevard. Joining us now is Miami Herald investigative reporter Carol Marvin Miller. Carol, always great to have you.
Thank you. Good to be there with you, Luis.
So there were, again, different reports coming in yesterday from the city and the state about these deaths. All right, what do we know?
I think yesterday this story was just, unfortunately, a quickly moving target. What we know is that there were 3 deaths overall from this facility on Commercial Boulevard, Willow Wood. Only one of those deaths, for only one of them do we have results of testing, and that fatality was a man named Richard Curran, a 77-year-old who had been in Florida for only about 8 years. Mr. Curran became ill earlier in the week with respiratory problems and a high fever. By Sunday, his condition had worsened dramatically. He had bacterial pneumonia, 103 fever, and his daughter had requested that he be tested. Oddly, this man's doctor at Holy Cross declined to have him tested, instead asking repeatedly whether Mr. Curran had been to China. But by late Sunday, they administered the test and it came back positive. He died shortly after that. The other 2 fatalities at that assisted living facility, the tests are not available yet. And so we just don't know whether these fatalities are linked to the COVID virus or whether they are unrelated. Remember, generally speaking, frail and elderly people live within nursing homes and ALFs, so deaths at such facilities would not be unexpected.
Yeah. What can you tell us about this, the Atria Willow Wood facility?
There are 180 residents, which makes it one of the larger retirement homes in South Florida or anywhere in the state. The majority of these homes in South Florida tend to be smallish mom-and-pop facilities. It is unremarkable, really, if you look at the records that are contained at the State Agency for Healthcare Administration, which licenses, inspects, and oversees long-term care facilities. There have been a handful of dings on their record in recent years, including a report from last year that faulted the facility for some lapses in care and for failure to have posted prominently numbers that residents could use to lodge complaints.
Phone numbers.
But having looked at those reports for decades, their record is really unremarkable. I don't think you could fairly accuse them of running a shoddy facility. And in fact, family members of Mr. Curran were happy with the care that he received there.
So I'd imagine with 180 patients, they have enough, I would say, healthcare workers working inside that facility.
Well, generally speaking, assisted living facilities are not the same as nursing homes. They don't provide the same level of care. You would expect that elders living in nursing homes are generally more frail, require a greater level of care than do residents of assisted living. And in fact, assisted living facilities run the gamut between what are really retirement homes where residents live independently to facilities where they receive a significant amount of care. I think Mr. Curran probably fell somewhere in the middle there. Willowwood has what's called a memory unit, and those are fairly common, especially in South Florida, and they cater to residents who have either Alzheimer's or other types of dementia, and they require fairly significant supervision because folks who have dementia sometimes forget where they are, they wander, they can find themselves in trouble if they leave the facility and get lost, things such as that.
Yeah. It wasn't that long ago we heard the governor say that, you know, he had asked Floridians, you know, don't visit these nursing facilities because, again, this population is in a lot greater danger than in any other age group. But do we know if any of these facilities are actually following that recommendation that they're keeping people out?
I think that they are. Anecdotally, I am told by folks who have loved ones in these facilities and by an advocate whom I trust that ALFs and nursing homes are enforcing the ban. Now, the ban cuts both ways because on the one hand, it does protect some of the more frail residents who might be exposed to this thing from visitors who go in there. On the other hand, and I think the advocates are particularly concerned about this, it also does away with an additional level of surveillance and oversight. I generally tell people who are looking to place a loved one in a long-term care facility that the best thing that they can do to protect their mom or dad or grandparents is to visit often, because like in so many other places, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And the best way to ensure that your loved one is receiving quality care is to go there, and especially, by the way, to go there during off-peak hours when it's less likely that they would expect you to visit.
Now that can't happen. And so are they providing opportunities for their patients to still be able to contact their families?
I don't know the answer to that. The facilities themselves are saying that they are encouraging and facilitating the use of, say, televisiting, where family members could Skype or Zoom with their loved ones. I have heard isolated complaints that some facilities are not facilitating those kinds of virtual visits. And that does worry me because, again, these visits from relatives and friends are critical to, as a culture, our ability to oversee conditions in these homes.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Carol Marvin Miller. We're talking about the latest report. Again, three deaths. One, we know, positive COVID-19 patient at the Atria Willowwood Assisted Living Facility in Broward County. And if you have a family member in a nursing home, or any of these assisted living facilities, share with us on social media how you're keeping in contact with them, What do you know about the facility and what it's doing to protect your loved one? Any stories that you've heard? You can find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. By the way, we also will share Carol's recent story on our social media as well. So, Carol, now the other thing, too, with this case is that the first responders who were called to this facility, you know, they were put at risk. What do we know about them?
We know very little about them. Yesterday, when I spoke with the mayor and a city commissioner in Fort Lauderdale, we were told that some first responders who were summoned to that facility on behalf of sick residents were exposed to the coronavirus. Certainly, anyone who came in contact with Mr. Curran was exposed to the coronavirus. I'm told that first responders who were in that facility are self-quarantined, and my guess is that they will remain isolated for 14 days, just like anybody else who came in contact. I've been home for about 10 days now because two of my colleagues were at a journalism conference in New Orleans in which someone tested positive. And so the Miami Herald has sought to limit exposure. And several of us who may have been exposed were sent home and told to stay there. As to the firefighters and paramedics who went to this facility, we just don't know whether any of them have tested positive.
And what about the workers of this facility? You know, have they been tested, or how are they, again, protecting themselves?
I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you that through the Miami Herald's reporting, I know that there is a deficit of testing kits. There is a deficit of protective gear and masks. We are being told that healthcare workers are very concerned about their ability to protect themselves given this dearth of protective equipment. I would imagine that anyone who came in contact with these three people has been told to go home and isolate themselves. That's just prudent.
The governor has said that he has a task force traveling the state, examining all nursing home facilities that have previously failed inspections. But do we know where the state is in that process?
We do not, which brings me to something I wanted to bring up. And that is we wrote a story a week ago about how the federal Health and Human Services Department had suspended all non-critical, non-emergency inspections of long-term care facilities such as nursing homes and ALFs. And what they were doing was to ration their resources, and by resources I mean inspectors, people who go in these places and look for compliance with state and federal guidelines for how facilities should be run. It is understandable that resources would run thin, but advocates for elders are very concerned about the suspension of these kinds of inspections because that is how problems arise. That is how we find out about inadequate care, about substandard conditions. Generally, the greatest number of such inspections are sparked by complaints from family members or visitors. And if we simply can't get into these places and poke around for several months, advocates are very concerned about conditions worsening within long-term care.
So again, we hear from the state about what we should be doing and not doing, again, not visiting these sort of facilities, not visiting nursing homes and putting the elderly at risk. But I mean, you know, I think back to the tragedy after Hurricane Irma, and, you know, we're finding that facilities, you know, have checkered past or they don't have remarkable past when it comes to trying to meet regulations and, of course, complaints that are filed. But, you know, with the state putting such emphasis on protecting the elderly right now, is there also a push to make sure that these ALFs are doing more than just closing their doors to outsiders, but that they're actually you know, really taking care of their patients and making sure that there is access to communicating with family and, again, protecting their workers.
The problem for someone like me, a reporter, is that we can't get in these places. The best that we can do is to cast a wide net and to encourage the families of elders and advocates for elders to talk with us about what they know and what they've seen. And they're not seeing anything because they cannot get in there either. I can tell you, having reported on long-term care for decades, that the lack of aggressive oversight and regulation has been a persistent problem in Florida for decades. The complaint that I hear regularly from advocates is that Florida regulators are mostly too cozy with the industries themselves and not responsive enough to the complaints and the concerns of real Floridians. And if that is true, and my reporting has suggested that it is, then we have good reason to worry, because what our concerns might have been over a long period of time, multiply them, because this thing is very dangerous toward elders. It is easily spread, we're finding out. And if there is a dearth of oversight within these facilities at present, then I think we have very good cause to be concerned.
And taking that into consideration, I mean, for our listeners, for your readers who have family members in these kind of facilities, what should they be aware of in terms of what the standards these facilities should be following? And of course, how to track that?
Well, my parents are deceased, unfortunately. But if I had a loved one, and by the way, my father lived in ALF for a few years. He was very happy there and very well cared for. And I say that because I don't want my comments to be misconstrued as, you know, we think that these facilities are all bad. They're not. Some of them are excellent and have a very high quality of care. If I had a loved one in one of them, I would be doing everything in my power to have virtual visits with them as often as I could. Now, you don't want to disrupt operations by making yourself a nuisance, but I think if your mom and dad is at a nursing home and you cannot gain access to them, you should do everything that is in your power to be able to FaceTime with them or Zoom with them or however you would have a virtual conversation. And ask your loved one to take that camera and pan the room, see what the room looks like, because, you know, you can get a pretty good idea of what the care is like just by the physical condition.
Very, very important thing to think about, you know, again, in these very strange times. We've been talking again with Miami Herald reporter Carol Marbin Miller. Carol, thank you again so much.
You're most welcome. Take care of yourself.
And you as well. You know, I can speak just to my own experience, having grandparents who passed away a few years ago. They lived in a nursing facility, one in northern Florida. It might be challenging for some, because I know with their, you know, at the end, especially in their conditions, they didn't have the ability to use telephones or cell phones or especially any of the other technology that we're talking about. So let us know, you know, your personal story. If you have loved ones right now in any of these ALFs, what it's been like for you in trying to stay in touch with them. Find us on social media, WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. And if you work in any of these facilities, let us know right now what it's like and what you're doing to try to protect your patients. Well, still to come, Vice President Joe Biden won Florida by a wide margin yesterday. We're going to look at the day in Florida's primary coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Democratic voters in Florida have spoken. Vice President Joe Biden is the candidate they want to move forward to challenge President Trump. Biden took over 1 million votes and defeated Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders by almost 40 percentage points. Biden also won in Arizona and Illinois. Ohio and Louisiana pushed back their primaries under fears of the spread of COVID-19. We're joined now by Susan McManus, University of South Florida Distinguished University Professor Emerita and political analyst. Susan McManus, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. Great day yesterday. Very interesting.
It was an interesting day. You know, as we were going into the primary, though, what was your biggest concern? Because, again, this is a very these are strange times.
Well, going into it, once the coronavirus started, everyone, of course, was worried about turnout being affected. The good news, as you know, and most of us who track this kind of thing, we're well aware of the fact that for a couple of election cycles now, Florida's trend has been towards people voting by mail and voting early, and usually two-thirds vote that way, and the pattern was held true again. But I think everyone was worried about people not turning out. And of course, interestingly, before the election, everyone was really in a quandary about cybersecurity, but you've heard nothing about that whatsoever, other than it wasn't an issue, even in calls to hotlines at the Secretary of State's office. It just wasn't an issue.
Yeah, that has definitely taken a backseat for now. So I'm taking it from what I'm hearing from you that Florida was right to go forward with its primary because we saw what Ohio and Louisiana did.
I think a lot of people would say that the uncertainties of being able to complete an election that so many people have voted, and we saw the number of Democrats voting actually went up here when it went down other places. It's never an easy call, but on the other hand, closure, and I think it would have been different if we hadn't seen the overwhelming support that Biden was getting relative to Sanders. Yes, we've complained a lot about polls, but this was one of those situations where the polls had such a wide margin of victory for Biden that the results were pretty much known. I don't think it really would have changed the election results all that much.
And looking at voter turnout, as you said, more people now voting early, voting by mail, but what did we see by voter turnout that we might expect to see in November?
Obviously, a lot of enthusiasm on both parties, because what sort of got lost in all of this was the fact that Donald Trump got enough delegates here to secure the nomination. So Florida was just put him over the top. He got all 122 delegates to the national convention. I think you're going to see a very, very close contest in Florida. This election showed a lot of enthusiasm on both sides. It also showed some cracks on each side's base that will have to be attended to. We don't know, however. I think the biggest unknown that will be very different, and we have to wait and see for the general election, what about all these 28% of Floridians who are not registered as Democrats or Republicans who were not able to vote in these party primaries, selecting delegates to the national convention?
Yeah, looking at, and that's true. You point out, the fact that the president is always on the ballot, is also on the ballot, but who is challenging him?
Obviously, you have within the Republican Party a sizable, around 6% that voted for some other candidate. There were three others on the ballot, one of whom had already left the race, but the one that got the most was the former governor of Massachusetts. And we do have quite a few people from Massachusetts that have moved to Florida. So some of it could have been that, but I think some of it's just people who don't like the president, and this was a way for them to express their opinions. Around 6% of the Republicans voting did not vote for the president.
You said a moment ago, too, that, it's been the trend. And I don't know if it's this, the COVID-19, and we don't know how long this is going to last and what it might do to November. But do you think that's kind of where we're going? Is we're heading in a direction where more people are just, that's how they're going to want to do it. Early voting, but also more by mail. Why show up?
Well, let's talk about especially the vote by mail. A lot of it depends upon, because we get the mail ballots, we can get them so far ahead of time, almost a month ahead of time, if not more. If you just quickly vote it and turn it back in, you see what happens. I mean, well, people who voted in the Democratic primary had 16 candidates to choose from, only three of which are live candidates. And it is true that the Democratic Party of Florida sent out a blast, sort of urging Florida Democrats, you know, hold off till we see, especially after Super Tuesday, till we see where things are going and who drops out. And you even had a couple of newspapers editorializing. I think the Sun Sentinel came out with an editorial urging people to hold on to their ballots a little bit longer. So that's kind of one side of it. It won't be quite the issue in November, because obviously it'll be down to a two-person field. But vote by mail when you've got a crowded field and in the presidential preference primary, at least, can cause some unusual kinds of things. Let's be realistic, though, in talking about why this impetus to vote by mail and vote early. A lot of it is because both parties have made it an aggressive part of their get out the vote mechanisms, because they can track voters, and then that leaves the kind of follow-up and last-minute impetus to get people at the polls on election day. They can sort out the people who have already voted early in person or by mail. So both parties have had a real impetus in recent years to move in that direction. But I do think that one of the things that has become very apparent is that if you have a crisis, like a health crisis, I mean, this is unprecedented, granted, but we would have never had the cancellation at the last minute of poll workers had we not had the age makeup of our election day poll workers in so many places. Thankfully, our supervisor of elections in Florida are very good at having backup plans and bringing in other public officials and so on and so forth. So it wasn't a huge issue, but that is one of the sides of downsides. If you have a catastrophe or an emergency or something, and election day poll workers choose not to show up for legitimate reasons.
Yeah.
But you also have the problem with having to change, you know, precinct locations.
And that, we saw that in a couple of districts here in South Florida, poll workers not showing up. And also, there were people who were trying to get to their precinct and finding out what it got moved. That was really the worst that we've heard so far. Again, I'm talking with Susan McManus, political science professor emeritus at USF. We are reflecting on yesterday's primary results in Florida amid the impact of COVID-19 and of course, what this all means for the general election in November. All right, so, you know, I'm not the guy who's going to do the math. I'm going to trust that to the experts. And everything says that right now, Vice President Joe Biden has the strong edge. Barring some disaster, he's pretty much the nominee at this point. But what did we learn from yesterday about his performance and what that means for the general election? You said it. Florida, again, is probably going to be really close.
Right. Well, in terms of looking at the votes and so forth, it is clear that Florida Democrats still have quite a bit of work in Biden as well, even though he did very well with Latinos compared to how he did in other states. Obviously, Florida's Latino population is quite different. But I looked at some of the numbers still suggest, and we haven't run the data yet, that there's still a turnout problem among the Hispanic communities in Florida. That will have to be addressed. Really strong support from Black voters and from moderates. But I think the biggest challenge that Biden will have is sort of an even expansion of the problems that Hillary Clinton had, and that's with younger voters who support Bernie Sanders primarily for strong ideological feelings. And the danger is, and we've seen it in some other places already, is not turning out that demographic. Now, yes, we typically expect young voter turnout to be lower in primary elections, and especially when it's spring break, let's be real. But, you know, we don't always expect the generational difference in turnout to be there in a general election, but the potential is there this time as it was for Hillary. Hillary lost Florida because younger Sanders supporters did not show up to vote at all. They just didn't vote for president. That's a real problem still. But I think the other challenge for Vice President Biden are his sometimes memory gaffes or whatever, which makes his selection of a vice presidential running mate really probably much more important than it typically is in the past. Someone that's going to be ready to step right in, and the public feels that if something happened to him health-wise, and it's true for Trump too, both of them are older, health issues could kick in and somebody else would have to step up. But I think for Biden, there is that concern that's been articulated even by some Democrats worrying about that. And this selection of a VP is critical.
And he said that he is choosing a woman. He said that in the last debate, that he is going to be choosing a woman for his VP candidate. Well, you know, South Florida, we look at Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach County tend to be blue. But another very important part of Florida is the I-4 corridor. What do we know from yesterday about how he performed there?
He was a little, I-4 corridor, Tampa and Orlando media markets. That is the most competitive geography in Florida. And that's where, again, yesterday we saw a closer race between Biden and also Sanders. I mean, that's the area that was a little lighter blue, whereas your part of the state was very dark blue. So you did see some fall off there and more Sanders vote in that area. We haven't looked at it closely, but I'm guessing that some of that is the Puerto Rican vote, which is different from Southeast Florida's Latinos, like Venezuelans, Colombians, and Nicaraguans, Cubans, etc., which are a little bit more conservative, especially on the socialism issue. But Puerto Ricans are a different type of Latino culture and voting pattern. So, and there's a lot, I think, younger populations that did turn out a little bit higher in this area that were Sanders leaning. So this is still very competitive. Nonetheless, by anybody else's standards, it was still a blowout for Biden in those areas, but lighter than elsewhere. The only county that really came very close at all was Alachua, home, of course, to the University of Florida.
So how does the president's approval rating look right now in his home state, again, amidst this pandemic?
I think we don't have a good read on it. The last poll I saw, and I'm a little bit disappointed, even in the exit polls that were done in Florida, where the small sample size makes one a little bit suspect. In fact, there were sample sizes on some of the questions were so small as to be inadequate to report any data on the questions that were asked in the exit poll yesterday in Florida. It was disappointing. So I don't think we know, but I do know that what I have seen is he's hanging in there. He's still right at the 50% or 49%, or this is still a toss-up. Let's be realistic. This is still a toss-up state, but huge, huge unknown is the economy and what impact that's going to have. We are likely to see a very, very different issue importance ranking by the time we get to November than we're seeing right now.
And we've got a long time before that November election, so lots to talk about till then. Susan McManus, again, USF Political Science Professor Emeritus. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, the number of coronavirus cases continues to rise in Latin America. Different countries approaching this pandemic very differently. We'll get to that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. As we mentioned, last night included big victories for Vice President Joe Biden here, especially in Florida's primary. Many analysts question whether Biden would be able to secure votes from Florida's Latino population. In California and Nevada, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders swept the Latino vote, but the politics of Florida's Latino population, very different. And Sanders' prior comments about socialist regimes in Latin America may have had an impact on his performance here. WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett joins us now to talk about that, but also, and we're going to get to how Latin America is responding to this COVID-19 outbreak. Tim, great to have you.
Hi, Lewis. How are you?
And also joining us in the studio, Sundial producer Alejandra Martinez. She's been reporting on the Young Latino Vote for WLRN and the NPR program The World. Alejandra, great to have you.
Hey, Lewis.
Okay, so what did yesterday's vote show us about how Latinos feel about the candidates, but especially about Senator Sanders? I mean, we heard a little bit from Susan McManus. Tim, what do we know? What did it teach us?
Well, we know in general that Biden defeated Sanders by almost 40 points. That's a pretty resounding rejection of Sanders in Florida. All we really know at this point, because we haven't seen much in the way of exit polling from Latinos specifically, all we know is that the day before the primary, Univision put out a poll that showed Biden ahead of Sanders with Latinos in Florida by 8 points. My hunch, though, is that the spread yesterday was much larger.
And what about with the Cuban population? What do we know, especially about, again, with everything that the senator had said that was controversial, what do we know about how that moved Cuban voters?
I would say the gap was even larger among Cubans, because even moderate and liberal Cubans, for the most part, seemed offended by Sanders' remarks, complimenting, praising the late Cuban dictator Fidel Castro in many respects. Although Sanders did say that he opposes the, quote, authoritarian nature of the Cuban regime, still, his remarks just stuck in the craw of Cubans, whether they were conservatives, moderates, or liberals here. And I think in that community, which amongst Latinos is you know, usually produces the most voter turnout in elections in Florida, he was in really big trouble with that cohort.
Ali, how did, because we saw the senator, debate after debate, he was questioned about this and he had his response, but how did Sanders' comments continue to come up after debate after debate?
So yeah, after the 60-minute video, every single debate or press event or something that Sanders did, somehow this, conversation around his communist and socialist, label and the comments that he had about Fidel Castro kept coming up. Either journalists kept pressing him on it, or it was just a topic that kept appearing after and after debate. And, to add to Tim's point about how it was resonating with the Cuban population, I think there's definitely also, you have to look at, is it first generation Cuban, second generation Cuban, and third, this generational divide, and like, how are young Latinx voters responding to Sanders' comments?
And that's part of the reporting that you've been doing for The World especially. And I wonder, what are we seeing in the generational divide? What are younger Latinx voters saying about how they felt of those comments?
Yeah, I've been talking to, young first-time voters. These are typically 17, 18-year-olds, maybe 19, 20, who will be voting at, this is their first presidential election. And I asked them, is this socialist label? Is this thing, these comments that, Bernie Sanders is making affecting the way that you're voting? And for them, it's not really about these labels. It's more about the issues and the things that are impacting their lives right now in America. So like student debt and, healthcare for all.
Tim, the other thing, too, is this. I'm wondering how, considering the times that we're living in, everything, and we don't know how this is going to play out, how this virus is going to play out by November. But right. What's changed with Latino voters, going into this election? Or do you think there's still a lot of time?
Oh, I think there's still a lot of time. And as Ali pointed out, issues like healthcare, I think, as we move to the general election, are going to become much more important to Latino voters, even in Florida, than questions about, sympathies for socialist dictatorships in Latin America. So I think now that we've sort of passed this Bernie Sanders episode in Florida, I think you're going to see the Latino electorate in Florida perhaps focused on a wider variety of issues than just, quote, socialism.
You know, Ali, before we let you go, is, you know, you're doing this reporting again for The World. Just real quickly, yes. Remind us of what you're doing.
So WLRN The World is looking at first-time young Latinx voters here in South Florida. So if you're a young Latinx voter, this is going to be your first election that you're going to be voting in. Please contact us. You can look us up at WLRN on social media and let us know who you will be voting for, what are the issues that matter to you, and what are your concerns.
Definitely an interesting story. Again, if this is the first time that you're voting, you know, in a presidential election. Ali, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, hearing from WLRN producer Alejandra Martinez, and we're also speaking with WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. As we mentioned, Vice President Joe Biden winning big in Florida in yesterday's primary. And you can follow our reporting on last night's primary results. Go to WLRN.org. Tim, I want to transition to Latin America and the coronavirus pandemic. Where are we seeing the biggest numbers of cases so far? Where is it getting bad?
Right now, not surprisingly, in Brazil, and that was also the site of the first case last month in the city of Sao Paulo, which in itself was not surprising because Sao Paulo, its citizenry, has so many ties to Italy, and North Italy in particular. And so we have also seen the first two deaths from coronavirus in Brazil. So we're starting to see things ratchet up, unfortunately, but not unexpectedly in Latin America.
You wrote last week about Cuba accepting a number of coronavirus passengers on a cruise ship from the United Kingdom. What were the circumstances in which these people needed to be offloaded? What was the story there?
Well, this was a cruise ship based out of the UK, and it was sailing in the Caribbean, and suddenly they discovered they had at least five passengers on board who tested positive for the new coronavirus. And the problem being, however, that when you've got passengers with that condition on board, it's very hard to get countries, especially small island countries in the Caribbean, to let you dock at your ports. And so they couldn't find any place to dock. The UK government put out a call in the region for somebody to let this ship come into port so that these passengers could disembark. And Cuba stood up and said, yeah, we'll take them. They called it a health emergency, and they claimed that these five passengers' lives were at risk, as well as about 20 other passengers and 20 other crew who were thought to be carrying symptoms of coronavirus. And that ship is due, I believe, today to come into the port of Mariel in Cuba.
What are Latin American countries, but especially, you know, the Caribbean countries, doing when it comes to the issue of cruise ships and you know, docking, allowing them to dock in their ports? And again, you've got people coming in and on and off these things.
It's going to be a huge conundrum for the Caribbean when you consider just how much of an economic staple the cruise line industry is for these islands. They are walking a very thin line right now between keeping themselves economically viable, but at the same time not panicking their residents on those islands, because they feel particularly vulnerable. Their medical systems are not exactly the most robust in the world either, and it's just a very, very angst-ridden dilemma for these islands, like the Bahamas, where this ship was anchored off of before Cuba finally gave it the green light to come there.
We talk about the challenge of testing enough people here in this country. What are the testing capabilities like in Colombia, Argentina, Mexico, the Caribbean?
They're better than they were 5 years ago for the Zika epidemic. I think that's one of the lessons that these Latin American and particularly South American countries learned, was just how far behind the curve they were during that epidemic when it came to testing. And they can thank the University of Miami, for example, for helping them develop tests during that Zika epidemic. And my University of Miami is doing the same, I believe, during this coronavirus epidemic for Latin American countries, helping it develop test kits. And I think, you know, the better coordination with the Pan American Health Organization, et cetera, allowed them to be on a better footing with regards to testing when this new epidemic hit the continent.
So, of course, the U.S. now banning flights from different parts of the world, you know, recently from Europe, closing borders. What countries in Latin America right now are doing the same? Are, you know, banning flights, closing borders, just try to keep people out?
Just about all of them. I think we've seen Colombia was the first, I think, to close its border because it receives so many Venezuelan migrants because of the economic and humanitarian crisis there in Venezuela. And many of those migrants are bringing in other diseases like malaria, dengue. And so there was a big fear, obviously, that they would be, many of them would be bringing in coronavirus as well. So they, over the weekend, closed their borders with Venezuela. Now we've seen Colombia close its borders with Ecuador, Peru. We're seeing Chile do the same thing, Ecuador doing the same thing. And I believe Brazil also closing some of its borders. So they realize now, you know, just a week ago, they were seen as the region of the world that had a very light caseload. That has skyrocketed since then. And they realize they've got to take tighter measures.
And you mentioned Venezuela. I mean, already dealing with its challenges.
Exactly.
You know, I'm concerned that, I'm sure a lot of people are concerned that we're going to get any accurate information out of Venezuela. What's going to be the challenge in knowing what's happening there?
Well, I think we're going to have to lean on Venezuela. The international community is going to have to lean on Venezuela for honest data, which frankly, the international community feels it did not get from Venezuela during the Zika crisis. In fact, during that crisis, Venezuela, its socialist regime, reported only about 4,000 cases, whereas independent doctors groups were estimating as high as 400,000 cases of Zika. So, yeah, Venezuela does not have a very good reputation right now when it comes to that. And the international community is really going to be leaning on Venezuela. And you know, it's really already starting to hit Venezuela hard economically. Just yesterday, the Maduro administration asked the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, for a $5 billion loan. The IMF rejected them because it simply cannot trust the data, the information that it's getting from Venezuela regarding this crisis.
You know, again, seeing these borders being closed to everybody, but I'm wondering the governments of the U.S. and Canada and of Latin American countries, how are they working together to help each other in this time?
Well, I think what you're seeing mostly is the kind of coordination that I was talking about earlier with universities like the University of Miami helping medical systems in countries like Brazil or even poorer countries like Bolivia, and the Pan American Health Organization, for example, stepping up quite a bit to get them the things they need, particularly as we were discussing before, the testing kits. You know, if they can test enough people in a timely enough fashion, I think they can keep their caseloads, their infections, and their infection transmission in these countries down. One of the big concerns is when the Southern Hemisphere winter comes to South America, will those conditions become more favorable to transmission of coronavirus? That's one of the theories. So that's one of the things we've got to look out for as we approach what for us is summer, but for them, winter.
Yeah. And you know, Tim, I mean, you have family in Venezuela. I'm wondering what you're hearing.
They're telling me that they're just observing quarantine. They are locked down in many ways, the same way Italy is. Maduro, knowing that his medical system is so decimated by this economic crisis down there, he's ordered a virtual lockdown of the country. And so, people like my relatives, yes, they are experiencing a genuine quarantine situation right now.
We've been talking with WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. You could follow his reporting at WLRN.org. Tim, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lewis.
Well, the U.S. Census is rolling out as the world battles against this coronavirus pandemic. The count is important because it's going to reshape districts and it's going to impact future elections. It will also determine how federal dollars are spent in different communities. But will COVID-19 have an effect on the final count? Earlier today, we spoke with Tim Olson. He's the Associate Director for Field Operations at the U.S. Census Bureau. And he told us that the count is still on and believes there will be no delay. Olson makes the case that census is important in battling COVID-19.
When you think about this situation, this pandemic, you know, obviously CDC and other health professionals, they're working really hard on a vaccine. They're also working how to contain this, how to stop the spread or slow down the spread. Census data tells the truth. How many people are in the universe? How many people live in each state? Those numbers, they sound like just a number, but that's the backbone for them to do their analysis when they do their research. So, I can't say it enough. Critical. It's absolutely critical that we have a true picture of who the nation is so that when these crises happen, they're basing their research and their decisions on fact rather than, something else.
So as of right now, Olson tells us that they have received over 500,000 applications from people that want to volunteer as census workers, and they will be going through training to stay safe during this pandemic.
Part of that training, right now, is absolutely use social distancing as the primary concept when you're making contact with householders. Second, if you in any way, shape, or form are ill or have a fever or anything going on with your body, do not work, period. And third, practice those hygienic techniques that we're all learning about. Because things are so rapidly unfolding, we're being really sensitive to this. We don't want to put anybody in the American public at risk because of this activity. And we certainly don't want to put any of our temporary employees at risk.
Well, Census Day is April 1st. You should be receiving census invitations by mail. Another safe way to fill out the form is online at my2020census.gov. Well, that is Sundial for this Wednesday, March 18th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington, and Alejandro Martinez is our associate producer, as well as our social media editor. Katie Leprey is WLRN's engagement editor. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. And our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, Congresswoman Donna Shalala joins us to discuss the federal response to COVID-19. Shalala was the director of Health and Human Services under the Clinton administration, and under her tenure, the country secured the highest immunization rates in U.S. history. We're going to speak with her about the U.S. response to this global pandemic. Now, all program, we've been listening to the local band Afro Beta. Yesterday, we told you how musicians are bringing concerts to their audiences. Afro Beta is hosting a special live stream concert from North Beach Bandshell, a performance where the audience is all online. It will be, we're going to tweet out, by the way, a link to the stream. It will be tonight. You can find it at WLRN Sundial. Thank you again for listening. I'm Luis Hernandez. We'll talk to you tomorrow.